Welcome to Rights Watch, a program about human rights around the world from Human Rights Watch. I'm Jesse Graham. This is the show for Monday, September 28th. There's a new opening at the United Nations this week. For the first time, the UN will assign a special representative for women and conflict. It's been a long time coming. We'll talk later in the show about Congo, where this new UN office could have tremendous impact. But first, to Mariana Mullman. She's with the Women's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch.
In the year 2000, the Security Council of the United Nations set out a blueprint for how women and girls are affected differently by conflict than men and boys. So that both has to do with sexual violence. It also has to do with women as participants in conflicts, as combatants, and it has to do with women in decision-making positions after a conflict. And so that was in 2000. Ever since then, what we've heard is all words and not very much action. There hasn't even really been an assessment of why it is that the UN system has been so incapable of dealing with sexual violence or of putting women in decision-making positions with regard to post-conflict situations. So what we're seeing now is the UN finally assigning a leadership position, somebody who can head up with some force, with accountability, with funding behind the implementation of this promise that comes from 2000. So we're very excited that this is happening. We're also a little bit apprehensive that it's been such a long time coming. So we'll see what's going to happen.
So let's talk a little bit about how this came to be. I understand It has to do with the resolution that was passed declaring rape as a weapon of war.
That's right. The first thing that happened was actually the General Assembly talking about rape generally and how rape is not such a good thing, which led the Security Council to take up the same issue. And I think sometimes for those of us who work on these issues sort of on a daily basis, it's a little bit confusing why there has to be so much talk and negotiation about issues that really have been solved a long time ago. So, you know, when you think about international law as a process, rape has been designated or has been talked about as a weapon of war for years.
And so the conflict in the Balkans was a place where this, I mean, where did it sort of begin to take shape?
So it started exactly with the conflict in the Balkans, with the Security Council setting up two ad hoc tribunals, so international courts on both the former Yugoslavia and also on Rwanda that included rape as a possible component of crimes against humanity. And then that led to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, where we see the same sort of blueprint again for thinking about sexual violence as part of how parties to armed conflicts are really humiliating each other, creating terror, and using sex as a weapon.
Do we have an example in the UN system of another office that was set up to do something like this that has succeeded? Are there mechanisms that we know work?
Absolutely. This is not something new. There is, for example, a special representative on children armed conflict set up a number of years back that looks in particular on the recruitment of use of child soldiers. And this has led to a listing of parties to armed conflict that recruit and use child soldiers, which, you know, sort of a naming and shaming mechanism. Countries really want to get themselves off this list and show that they don't use children as combatants. And we're looking for something similar, a similar push, a similar leadership, a similar visibility exercise and accountability on women in armed conflict.
Tell me a little bit more about what you expect practically.
One of the reasons that we're so excited about this new position is that it will really move the UN to a place where the system as a whole can say, we're dealing with our part in this. Now, member states, you step up to the plate. You know, and up until now, what we've seen is sort of a wishy-washy, somewhat not taking this so seriously approach from the UN. And there have been positive steps, you know, before, but really no coordinated action. So we feel that when the UN is stepping up to the plate with, you know, at a level that signals accountability, seriousness, funding behind this, the member states will have to follow suit.
There's no science to this. How do you stop men from raping when they're at war? I mean, it does seem kind of insurmountable.
It is, and it does. I mean, sometimes that is, I have my days on sexual violence. You know, a question that I get quite often is, why does this happen? Why are we not stopping this? And at the most basic level, You know, rape happens in war and outside of war because we're allowing it to. Once you start analyzing it, it happens because women in many cases are seen as extensions of men or as seen as bearers of culture or as seen as values to the community as an object. And so one of the stories that has impacted me the most is I met a health worker from the Sudan who'd worked in Darfur. And he said to me that, you know, obviously he got a lot of rape victims through his clinic. And he said to me, at first I thought that the combatants that came through were raping the women for sexual pleasure. And then I started seeing how they mark the women with their knives. So once a woman has been raped, they'll basically carve into her, you know, mark, this person has already been taken. And then the subsequent combatants that came through would not rape those women because they were already territory that had been occupied. And so that's how, you know, the devaluing of women's lives or the valuing of women's lives only as objects and possessions leads to rape being used as a weapon of war. Now, that's why recent Security Council resolutions talking about myths that fuel sexual violence are so important. We must get at these underlying inequality perceptions and prejudices.
And even if no woman or girl was raped again in war starting tomorrow, we still have thousands of people who've survived this. How do you deal with that? And is that part of what the UN office will do, dealing with aftercare and treatment of these people?
Absolutely. The Special Representative on Women, Peace and Security will be charged with issues related to sexual violence related to conflict. And that means also in the post-conflict aftermath, a number of countries that have recently come out of conflict see real problems with access to health care, in particular physical health care, HIV issues, but also mental health care and issues related to the children that are born of this violence. So this is something that the Special Representative certainly can deal with. Unfortunately, I think that he or she will be very much engaged with the prevention of sexual violence in the first place for many years to come. This is not something that will go away easily, but now we have a machinery to deal with it.
It's a big job.
It certainly is.
Thank you, Mariana.
Thank you for having me.
Now let's talk about one place where the new UN Office on Women and Conflict could have a huge impact. That's Congo. The UN estimates that 200,000 women and girls have been victims of sexual violence there since 1998. Yuliana Kippenberg is a children's rights researcher at Human Rights Watch. She's been investigating sexual violence in Congo for nearly a decade. She's on the line with us from Berlin. Yuliana, what do you hear from the groups you work with in Congo about this new UN initiative? Are people hopeful about it?
People are hopeful about that, but in general, I would say New York seems very, very far away to the women and girls of Eastern Congo who continue to suffer really sexual atrocities on a day-to-day basis still. And, you know, obviously what they see is that MONUC, the UN peacekeeping force in Congo, is not doing enough to protect them and to protect them from attacks by armed groups or, and sometimes even the army or other attackers. So from their point of view, this is potentially hopeful, but at the same time, extremely far away.
And from your experience there with these women and girls, what have you learned about what this office, what this new office on women in conflict should do or can do to reach those women and girls and to change things there?
Well, we think that this office can basically take political leadership at the highest level, at the UN. And what I mean by that is, for example, you know, pushing for national and sometimes possibly even international prosecutions of rape as a war crime, you know, just ensuring that justice systems are actually put in a position to be able to prosecute and really ending the impunity for these crimes at higher levels, not just, you know, prosecuting ordinary men or ordinary foot soldiers, but actually, you know, senior officers, rebel leaders, and those sorts of people for their command responsibility or their own involvement in sexual violence. That can be, for example, a very important area of work. Another very important area of work is the representation of women in peacekeeping forces and, you know, much greater inclusion also of women into peace processes.
So tell me a little bit more about your experience on the ground in Congo when you first started working there. And I understand that you have seen some improvements recently.
When I first started working on this issue in eastern Congo, there were practically no specialized medical services for the victims of rape. And so, you know, women would die of the simplest infection, for example. And now there has been change on that. So, I mean, definitely medical services have improved. And in the big cities, there are actually real specialized medical services now, and often they can be obtained for free as well. With regards to prosecution, we have seen some limited progress as well. So, for example, in the last few years, there have been numerous rape trials of soldiers and numerous convictions as well. Last year, we've had 27 convictions of soldiers for rape in two provinces of eastern Congo that are deeply affected by the war in the south and north Kivu. And we see the trend continuing, possibly the numbers even slightly rising. This is very good. However, what we have also seen, there's basically a continued problem of impunity at the top. So senior officers of the army or rebel leaders and so on are not prosecuted, are very, very seldomly prosecuted.
And you've tried to address that by actually speaking to military justice officials and army commanders as well.
That's right. We interviewed various justice officials, various military officials, including the commander of a brigade that was directly involved in many, many cases of sexual violence. So we obviously are trying to bring about this accountability in many different ways, including by raising these issues very directly with the local and national authorities in Congo.
That was Juliana Kippenberg. She's a children's rights researcher at Human Rights Watch. There is a bright spot in this story in Congo. This summer, the Congolese military announced a zero-tolerance policy for sexual violence and other abuses. Since July, several rape trials have been open, one leading to the conviction of two high-level officers. This is a hopeful development in a story that we'll be watching for a long time. For more about rape in Congo and the new UN Office on Women and Conflict, please visit hrw.org. That's Rights Watch for today. Human Rights Watch is an independent organization dedicated to defending and protecting human rights around the world. Our podcast is available on iTunes and on our website, hrw.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, and you can send your ideas and questions our way at podcast@hrw.org. Thanks for listening to Rights Watch. I'm Jesse Graham.